Hey, welcome to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. And whether you're listening on iTunes, Podbean, or any of the other platforms that we're on, it's not very many, but the one you're listening on, if you could go hit the like, the follower button, the subscribe button, whatever button's available to you, hit one of them or hit all of them. And if you hit the subscribe button, you will get a notification when the next episode is posted. I keep trying that, and it keeps working for me because I have a Podbean account. So if you don't have an account, I don't know that that really works for you, but go ahead and give it a try and see how it is. Okay, we got a lot of stuff to cover, a lot of fun stuff too. First of all, obviously a tropical storm slash hurricane is bearing down on Florida. You know, the best advice is follow your local officials' guidance. If they tell you to leave, it's probably a really good idea to leave. And right now, before the storm hits, I would have make sure your car is filled with fuel and that you have a couple of cases of water, maybe some food that you can take with you, you know, MRE type stuff. And, you know, make sure you got a way to heat it, all those kind of things. You know, a lot of camping gear comes in really handy during something like this. So even if you don't evacuate but you lose power, you can still cook and kind of maintain your residence and a reasonable level of comfort. Just be a camping trip for a couple days. This happened to us last summer. A tornado came down and hit, wiped out power for just over a day, which is nothing compared to what other people, especially those in hurricane zones, have put up with. But you know, it's really nice. It's a good feeling to have the kind of stuff, you know, I can make it 72 hours. I can make it 96 hours. It's good to know that you have that stuff. Anyway, that's the best advice we can give you. You know, obviously the area you live in determines whether or not there is a threat of looters or stealers, whatever you want to call them. You know, whatever that local security threat is, you should be prepared for that also. I'll just leave that there and say that a good carbine with a reasonable ammo supply should be something that can secure your immediate vicinity. And so anyway, but other than that, we hope for the best, and we hope the people who are in the what appears to be the zone of this storm make it out okay. You know, this thing, I hope it just stays kind of out at sea, and maybe there's just some rain and a few things like that that are a lot more manageable than a hurricane hitting the coast. Okay, another thing that's come to us from one of the good friends of the podcast is, you know, that some of these gun control organizations are putting together what they call a peace plan. They're using this phraseology very deliberately. And I can't go into all of it. I've got to do some further research, but let me just give you the high points. Let me give you the short story. The short story of this is that they're using phraseology like peace plan so they can make it seem like there's an armed conflict going on in America. That is a trick. It is a psychological term that they're trying to use to get you to think a certain way about a situation. So they're trying to persuade you by using that term. The next thing is they're going to use what are effectively portrayed as traumatized children saying, you know, we got to get rid of these AR-15s. We got to get rid of all guns, make our schools safe. This is completely understandable that they would do that. That's probably their most effective technique. But, you know, it doesn't really bear any scrutiny. When somebody tries to use this on you, you can say, look, there's all kinds of school security measures. And you can point out that, you know, why don't school shootings happen in the inner cities? And the answer is because they have a lot of school security, including magnetometers, making sure that only students get into the school. They have police officers on campus that actually do something. You know, they have a whole lot of tools, and there's a lot more tools available that can make schools safe. So don't fall for any of this. This is a lot of nonsense, and they're using this. The good part about it is I think they're losing steam. I think most people are kind of looking at this going, you know, there's deeper problems here than just a gun. And most people understand that, 50, 60 years ago, guns were common around schools. People would put a gun in their car, go to school, and then go hunting on the way home. There were rifle teams in schools. And in some cases, there still are a lot. I think they've really converted to air rifles, but there were rifle teams in school. So it's not a gun problem, it's a behavior problem, and it's a problem that our society needs to confront. But stay tuned, there'll be some more on that as we do some research and a few other things emerge. Okay, we can now talk about my favorites on YouTube, my favorites. The crush to get content on YouTube is killing the quality of it. It's killing the quality. There are some guys that have to feel they got to put out a video a day, and that's great for consumers. But I find that the quality has really, really taken a nosedive. And so, Forgotten Weapons, if you're listening, you should think about the video a day strategy and think, is that really smart? 350 videos a year. I get it. He's trying to create a searchable database that covers practically every known type of firearm. That's a very commendable thing. I think that's, in the digital age, that's going to be a lot nicer than going out and buying $50 and $100 books, which is what some of these expensive gun books are costing now. These reference books, some of them cost $50 or $100. You just can't afford to go buy 20 of these things. It just cost prohibitive. So digitizing all this and having it as a quick access base is going to be the wave of the future, but don't sacrifice quality. The worst quality sacrifice I've seen lately, and against my better judgment, I actually watched it, is the InRange TV, their best battle rifle thing that they're just wrapping it up now. And they've done the shooting, and now they're going to come up with their conclusions, which I'm sure is going to be just some gobbledygook of data that they put together. And it's clear that they start with an agenda. And the agenda is these guys who kind of fancy themselves as this new breed of millennial shooters or whatever it is they're professing to represent. They don't, there's three rifles they don't, there's several things they don't like, but the three rifles they don't like are the G3, the FNFAL, and the M14. They don't like them, and they're not going to be well disposed towards them. You see in video after video, they continue to throw shade on this stuff. And they're trying to go against what has been the conventional wisdom for 50 or 60 years, which is these are three great designs that do things and are, give outstanding service. And they're trying to prove, well, they're basically shrouded in myth. And the reality is, they are distinctly inferior to what we have today. Now, I'm the first one to say, I think that there is truth that the more you develop something, the better it can become. And for certain types of shooting, the AR platform is the best. And it's the best in a lot of different ways and a lot of things. But that does not mean that everything else is inferior. It just doesn't. And it doesn't mean that it's so markedly inferior that it's obsolescent or useless. But their pitch is that it's not. And so they set up these tests. The other thing they don't like is full power cartridges. They're intermediate cartridge gamers. That's who these InRange TV guys are. They're intermediate cartridge gamers. And I looked at the shooters, quote unquote, they had conducting this test, and the fact of the matter is, none of them were proficient enough with the different types of firearms to really make me think there's any kind of expertise. Now, I guess you could make an argument that they're also uniformly bad, that they're basically their lack of expertise is a common denominator, which then somehow makes the test fair and equal, or gives it some sort of a baseline. I don't think that's true. I just saw people struggling with weapons that they were unfamiliar with and weapons that require a level of training. I mean, it's very simple. The other thing that I found very interesting was a lot of the times, and this kind of false analogy data they come up with, a lot of the times were just statistically insignificant. So it really doesn't matter if something is 0.95 seconds versus 0.92 seconds. That doesn't matter. That's just statistically insignificant. And in fact, I would say that you probably could not detect that difference with anything other than an electronic means. I mean, if someone does fires a acquires a target and fires a shot in 0.95 seconds and then immediately does it with 0.92 seconds, you're not going to be able to tell as an observer which one was faster. They're both going to look the same. And you know they have an agenda because their control firearms was an AR-15 and an AK-74 clone. So definitely the agenda is how well do these clunky old battle rifle cartridges in these awkward old battle rifles, how do they compare against the modern AR, the modern AK, and how does the modern AK kind of stack up against the modern AR? And the fact of the matter is, intermediate cartridge rifles are going to fire quicker. They are going to be easier to shoot. The AR is easier to manipulate vis-a-vis the AK system because it has the controls are more ergonomic and the magazine change is a lot cleaner, a lot simpler of an action to perform. So, there's no real secrets here. It's no secret that the G3, with the charging handle that's up near the front sight, is an awkward rifle. You have to be used to it. And what I saw is their shooters weren't used to it. Even the one guy who was a cop, I guess he was a cop, he looked like he could handle some weapons, but he did the one thing that I don't like, which is he had some sort of gamer thing where they hold the rifle down near the front sight. I've only seen that in three gun. I suppose there's some technique where they teach that, but like everything else, there's all kinds of techniques everywhere, and some of them are the most popular for a while, then they fade off into the background. So I also think that if you put left-handers, even a single left-hander, on primarily right-handed guns, and I think the Desert Tech MDR was the only truly ambi gun they had there. The ARs can get close, but they're still right. Everything is designed to be right-handed, so you put a left-hander in there, and you can skew the data quite a bit because the way they do have to do things is a lot different, and it's going to be generally, I found it's more time-consuming. It just is. So while left-handers have usually some very, very good workarounds, they're working around a design that was not that it was designed for a right-hander and they're left-handers. So they're working around the design rather than exactly with the design. So, all these things together kind of mitigate the quote data, which I'm sure will be an interesting deal. I don't know that I can, I don't know if I can sit through it. The BS meter may just peg out and I might have to bail on that, but I'll give it a try and start to listen to it. But it's a very interesting phenomenon that gamers don't take into account the power of a 7.62 NATO cartridge. The fact of the matter is, if you compare with all of their metrics, all of their measures of performance, an intermediate cartridge is always going to be easier to use, shoot faster, do all those things. But what they never take into account is the power on the other end. Now, I can tell you personally, the power on the other end is a big deal. That's why we had M14s in Iraq, and that's why you saw G3s hanging around Afghanistan, even though they'd been replaced in the German army. There were some G3s found their way there. There are some applications in which a 7.62 NATO is preferred. And one of those is machine guns. The M249 squad automatic weapon is a great weapon when you're firing against enemy troops. We found that firing them against vehicle-borne IEDs, they were poor. They can't, it doesn't inflict enough damage on the vehicle to stop it. The 7.62 NATO M240 was a much better weapon for that, and it could inflict enough damage to stop a car before it careened into you and exploded. I know this, I was there, I saw it. So I tend to disregard gamer opinions for this reason, and I tend to disregard a lot of law enforcement opinions for this reason. They don't go against vehicle-borne IEDs. They don't confront their adversaries with anything more than a handgun in the vast majority of cases. Very, very seldom do they actually use long arms. Now, they're trained to use them, and they have them reasonably available. But the fact of the matter is most police work that involves firearms is done with the service pistol that they carry and the issue service pistol that they carry. That's what it is. So there's a whole different category of performance that this test just did not take into account. So, you know, your mileage may vary. It is rushed together, and it is very poor quality content, in my opinion. We've gone over it in other podcasts, so I won't go over it here, but the M14, the G3, and FAL were designed with different priorities, and I've outlined those priorities, and you can go back to a previous cast and listen, but to try to put them all in the same basket, well, which one's the best? Well, first of all, the best is never defined, and they are the best at what they were specifically designed to do, and each one was different. Yes, they're all supposed to be battle rifles, but they have different design specifications and parameters that made them uniquely different. But in the final analysis, if you need a 7.62 NATO battle rifle, you really can't go wrong with the three rifles I mentioned earlier, or even the newer ones. You really aren't going to go too far wrong. They all have triggers. They all have about a 20-round magazine, and they go and go. It's just amazing that this test, one of the rifles that's doing the best overall is the original AR-10. It's made by Brownells. Fantastic rifle. In fact, it's actually doing exceptionally well, but that's because this whole thing is designed for a rifle with those kind of controls, those kind of ergonomics, and everything else. So that's what it is. And, you know, just watch this at your peril. That's all I can say. You know, they did this in concert with Primary Secondary, who do a podcast. I've listened to it a little bit. The problem I have with Primary Secondary is it's law enforcement centric, which does not interest me very much. And there's nothing wrong with that. The other thing they do that is very annoying is the first 30 minutes of the podcast, usually the panel or the guests, whatever they have, in addition to the host, they spend all their time giving you their resume. And I mean, you get 30 minutes of resume, and you can't remember. You don't even remember who these individual guys are. It's a podcast. You don't have the name face recognition that you would on a video or anything. And I've always found, especially, and they have some military guys on there. As a matter of fact, they usually have more military background people than police, but it is police focused. I've always found that the longer resume a military guy gives you, the less it really means. My current boss was in Delta Force, you know, Operational Detachment Delta, or in the trade they call it behind the wire. And if you ask him for his resume, or ask him, hey, what's your experience, he will just tell you some very basic stuff. It's over in 10 seconds. He doesn't go into, he was in Delta Force, he was this. You normally find the expertise of a military person through conversation where they've said, well, you know, I actually was part of that, or I actually did that, and here's what we found out. it's not when a guy is reciting his resume. Guys who recite their resumes are guys who don't have that strong a resume, or their resume is, they're using it to try to get an advantage over you. So therefore, I have no real interest in primary, secondary. To me, if I want to read resumes, I just I'll go to work and go to my job site, and I can read all the resumes I want. And just to wrap this up, I will talk again. We have a very good friend of the podcast, and he was born and essentially grew up overseas before coming to the United States. And he does not have a military or police resume. However, he lived in a place which had a social upheavals, economic upheavals, and he was actually real deal grabbed and interrogated by the paramilitary police. I mean, now, to kind of understand this, the thing you have to understand is that this was for real. This wasn't the survival, escape, and evasion school. This wasn't a course. This was the real thing where, you know, when I went through any kind of a SEER course or anything, it was, I knew that they really couldn't hurt me, and I knew that the thing would end, and I knew I would go back to whatever it was I was doing before, that this was a course. It wasn't completely real. It was a training opportunity to learn, but it wasn't real. Well, our podcast friend was actually grabbed, for real, interrogated, gun held to his head, with no idea what was going to happen to him. No idea. That is real experience, and that is something that you know, is out there. And a person may not have a flashy military or police resume, but they may have experiences like that which are relevant and real, and you can really learn from that. Plus, that's a very shaping experience. So just as military training shapes you, an experience like that can shape you also. So I'll just go ahead and say that that when it comes to the guys on in range or some of these other things, that there are some other people out there that have some experience also. And a lot of times it's a lot more relevant and real experience, which is why that part of this podcast is I criticize gun media. I mean, I go out after it. I critique it. I say when things are good, and I call out things that I think are not good. And I've given InRange TV both. I've given them kudos, and I've also called out a lot of stuff. So I'm pretty fair, I think. I'm pretty consistent. So anyway, that wraps up our deal on that. We'll now get into my favorite part of this podcast, which is questions and answers. And I got something a little different this time. Just like last time, we did almost all Q&A. This time, I was kind of influenced by something I was watching on YouTube, and it was the Tank Museum in England, which is a really wonderful place. I would like to visit there sometime. But they have all kinds of people come in, from experts to entertainers to anybody with an interest in tanks who's kind of well known or has a good opinion. And they have them list their top five tanks. So as I am not a tanker, my military service, the closest I got it with tanks was kind of following them around the battlefield there while I was on foot or in an M113 armored personnel carrier. So I was not a tanker. So I will go to what I think I know about, which is military weapons. And we've already talked about, you know, rifles in World War I, best bolt action rifles. So I thought that I would start with the top five military handguns. You know, what are the five best military handguns? So, I have two honorable mentions. And the reason they're honorable mentions are they just couldn't quite make the list, and it'll be pretty apparent why. But my first honorable mention is the M8 flare gun, which was a big, clunky, kind of 40mm flare gun. It's absolutely an outstanding piece of equipment. Most of them were made by the Eureka Vacuum Cleaner Company during World War II. And they stayed in service. I was issued one in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was stationed at the National Training Center. We would use it to, with different types of ammunition, we'd use it to replicate artillery or chemical strikes or something. So, or also if smoke was laid down, you could use various things to do that. We had the big smoke grenades too, but you know, you could have a pop. The nice part about it is it would kind of have a pop, and then you'd throw a smoke grenade, and so it would simulate an artillery round kind of landing, making some sort of noise, and then you'd have some smoke. Not a complete, absolutely authentic replication of what you would see on a battlefield, but enough of a simulation so that everybody got the idea. I imagine they're probably still in use somewhere. Somebody's probably got them. But during World War II, this was the signal gun that everybody used. And they were used on everything from PT boats to bombers, everything. Infantry used them to, you know, to signal flares, to shift fires and call up, you know, tank support, all kinds of things. They were used for all kinds of things. One of the most interesting is they were used in B-17s. They're flying back from Europe. If they had battle damage or wounded on board, or if their radio was knocked out, they could literally take the M8 flare gun. They would plug it into a fixture in the fuselage, and they could fire different colored flares, and that would let the ground crews know to have the fire trucks ready or an ambulance ready or something else. So it was an outstanding thing. Is it a hand? Well, it's a flare gun. You fire it by hand. It looks kind of like a big single-shot pistol, but it gets an honorable mention, and it is the number one honorable mention, just for the service it gave, and for all I know, may even continue to give. I haven't seen one for a long, long time, but I'm sure that they're still out there. Somewhere there's a use for those. Okay, the next honorable mention is a pistol that is not really good at anything in particular, but is just good enough so that it replaces a kind of a variety of handguns, and that was the Beretta 1934, a 380 auto. And if you've ever fired one of these, they're very compact. They feel very sturdy in the hand. They're all steel, and they hold, I think it's 7 shots of 380 auto, which is just marginally powerful enough to be a service automatic cartridge. But the pistol itself is small enough you can carry it concealed quite easily. So in the context of a war where everything is competing requirements, competing for resources, competing for industrial capacity, if you can produce a single type of handgun which fills a couple of different roles, is good for the police, good for the military, can be carried concealed, is it good enough, just large enough to be a duty gun? And it may not be great at any one of those things, but it's good enough at them, at all of them, that it's the optimal choice. So the Beretta 1934, because it did that, is really an excellent handgun, and it's really the second honorable mention behind the M8 flare gun. It's a good design. I even enjoy shooting them today. Safety's a little wonky on the Beretta 1934, but, you know, for what it is and the time frame it came out in, a very, very nice little convenient package. Not great at everything, not really great at any one thing, but good enough in all of them so that it could fulfill that and be a very efficient weapon for the Italian army, and a few others bought it as well. Okay. We're going to go up the list here, and I got to tell you that I did not use any single criterion. So something could be on the list for one reason, and the next one up could be on the list for an entirely different reason. It's not that I took the most accurate or the most reliable or this, that, or the other thing. They're all on here for different reasons, and I just rank ordered them because I felt that I rank ordered them to their importance, not necessarily their technical abilities or their proliferation or anything else. So, number 5 is going to surprise everyone. It's the Nagant 1895 revolver. Probably one of the worst issue sidearms it's ever been. I mean, the Nagant revolver is horrible. It's slow loading, horrific trigger pull, underpowered, complicated, And those are its good points. Okay, why is it on the list? Why would it be mentioned at all? Why wouldn't it be in the five worst handguns? And the answer is it probably would be in the five worst handguns, but the reason it's in the top five military handguns is because it absolutely proves how, for the most part, military handguns are irrelevant. They're irrelevant. In many cases, they're worn as a badge of rank by senior officers. In other cases, they're used as secondary or tertiary armament. They're used for guard duty. Very small things. And really, the Nagant revolver, it'll actuate a cartridge. It'll fire a cartridge, anemic as it is. And it's roughly probably the size of a 32 ACP, you know, about that power range. An 8mm kind of cartridge. It looks kind of like a full wad cutter because the bullet's back in, because it's a gas seal revolver. It's complicated to make sure that powerhouse cartridge didn't lose any velocity due to a cylinder gap, you know, in between the cylinder and the forcing cone of the barrel. So, anyway, but it just shows you the Russian Empire and later the Soviet Union fought two world wars with this gun, and literally there was no scream to get rid of them, because military handguns just aren't that important. And I realized during the Second World War the Tokarev was out in large numbers also, so you could really say, well, this was just a backup to the Tokarev. But the fact of the matter is, the Soviet Union kept making them up until the end of the war. You'll see them with 1943, 44, and 45 dates on them, and you'll see that most of them have been upgraded to their 1945 standard, which is an improved front sight. Why you would need that, I don't know, but I could go on and on and on about the terrible trigger pull. It's got to be 20 pounds. I mean, some of them are just, they're horrific. You could shoot them single action a little better, but it was a horrifically poor handgun. It never should have remained in service. It never should have been selected, because you have to load it one at a time like a single action army. The cylinder does not swing out. And it's slow loading, slow unloading, anemic, terrible ergonomics, terrible feel in the hand, horrid trigger pull, on and on and on. But it proves that even something as inferior and poorly designed as that could basically cut the mustard as a military handgun and be relatively successful, because the military handgun's role is not that big. So there you go. Now, I will say, they are fun pieces of history, and I'm not saying that they're junk and they should be thrown away. They're fun. They're great pieces of military history. But they are interesting for that aspect that they show how irrelevant military handguns can be. And they don't have to really perform very well to be successful, or at least widely used and continued production. Okay, number four on the list is the Luger, the German P08 Luger. Or you can include the earlier Lugers also. The reason the Luger is on the list, it was the first truly kind of modern semi-automatic handgun. And, you know, there's a reason why our handguns today don't look like the Broomhandle Mauser or some of these other ones that were out there. Basically, it was the Borchardt design, which had been radically redesigned into something that was actually, you could put in a holster, carry on your belt. It has the magazine release, the thumb magazine release, in exactly the right place, which you still find on the majority of handguns today. It had a good ergonomic grip. It had reasonable to see sights. I mean, they're not great by today's standards, but they're pretty good compared to other sights of the time, at least the equals of them. And so there, you know, the Luger was very, very reliable, and it fired what at the time was a powerful cartridge. A 9mm cartridge was a powerful cartridge in 1900, 1904, right around that time frame. So the first ones came out in 30 caliber, which was you know, a little higher velocity, a little less. And the U.S. Army actually bought 1,000 of them and tried them out and did not dislike them, but did not think that they would be a, that did not think they were really powerful enough, I think was the bottom line to adopt and use. So the Luger was highly successful, and in fact, I think the last Lugers in service were retired by the Finnish Army in the 1980s. You know, they held a few, they at least had some in reserve, and they basically retired those at the end of the 1980s. So Luger had a good run. The first truly modern kind of gave us the package of what a semi-automatic pistol would look like. And the next pistol, number three on the list, is the K-Frame Smith & Wesson. The K-Frame Smith & Wesson revolver is the probably one of the most prolific around-the-world revolver designs going. If they didn't have them from Smith & Wesson, whatever foreign military, they basically had a copy, and they were copied in Spain, they were copied all kinds of places, even in South America. The basic dimensions and operation of the K-Frame Smith & Wesson became the revolver of the 20th century, the duty revolver. Police and military, World War II, U.S. military used SCADs of K-Frame 38 Specials, and those things were in use up until the 90s. Our friend Sharpshooter sent me an email recalling that his squadron deployed to Desert Storm with those types of revolvers. They were old at the time, but they still had them. And, you know, they were all over in every policeman's holster. In a lot of countries, you know, the police are kind of a paramilitary phalangist organization. So the police are kind of supplied by the military, at least the national police. So the K-Frame Smith & Wesson 38 Special, in some cases 38 Smith & Wesson, the stubbier, earlier cartridge that the British used, and we made tens of thousands of them in that cartridge and gave them to the British Commonwealth, Australians, and everyone. But that became the revolver. I mean, it's something that you can recognize. You see it in newsreels. You see it everywhere. There's pictures. There's just evidence that was around the world. That pattern of revolver was around the world and very, very widely used. So that means it would have to be one of the top five military revolvers of all time. It just would have to be. Okay, number four on the list of top five military handguns is really the original, the Colt Walker. I know the Colt Patterson was out first and kind of got used by the Texas Rangers, but the first military issue revolver of consequence was the Colt Walker, 1847. Very powerful, very large. You can see YouTube videos on it. Look it up on Wikipedia. Essentially, 44 caliber, which translates actually to 45 caliber for us. Used as much as 60 grains of powder. Very powerful. They were actually so big they were carried in pommel holsters on the pommel of a saddle. And, you know, in an era of single-shot percussion weapons, both rifles and pistols, it was a quantum leap in firepower. It was a big deal, especially close-range firepower, which mounted troops or cavalry would be expected to fight. I mean, it would be expected to fight in very close range. And again, it was not perfect. It was ponderous. The metallurgy suffered, and a lot of them were sent in for repairs and things. But the fact of the matter is the Colt Walker started it, and nobody really looked back from there. Everybody went to revolvers. Nobody looked back. So the Colt Walker, 1847, and it really started a 100-year run of military revolvers. I guess actually technically 97 or 98 years, because by the end of World War II, the military revolver was done. It was not going to be used first line by anyone except for, you know, leftover examples, and they were replacing them as quickly as they could with semi-automatic pistol designs. But for 100 years, every battlefield had lots of revolvers on it, above it, behind it, everywhere. The military revolver was a fixture until the end of World War II. Okay, the numero uno, and this is not going to surprise anyone, no surprises. The numero uno military handgun is the 1911 A1. Just put it right up there. Reasons are it was the first genuinely kind of modern style military handgun. The Luger was close, but it was a little quirky and had design elements that it was just a dead end design. And nobody ever based any subsequent design on the Luger. The 1911 is really the prototype of almost every modern semi-automatic pistol design. The parallel ruler design of having the slide that moves back on the frame. Everybody has copied that concept in some fashion for their centerfire automatic pistols. They've also copied the locking mechanism and the controls, the sights. If you look at the number of military handguns, which are basically direct copies of the 1911, you find them in South America, you find them in Spain, you find them in Norway, you find them all over the place. You find that the number of militaries that have actually used the 1911 or its close copies are just in the dozens. So it is the greatest military handgun of all time. Plus, it also introduced one of the greatest pistol cartridges of all time, the 45 ACP. I mean, the 45 ACP is still considered a world standard. I mean, a lot of people like other things, and there's market. A lot of other things are in the marketplace, but 45 ACP has got a special place, at least here in America, probably other places too. It's a cartridge that is not only a great service cartridge, but it's also a great target cartridge, which, you know, is kind of unique, you know, that nobody really makes that claim of the 9mm, although there are some very good 9mm pistols. Really, when you talk about a semi-automatic centerfire target pistol, most people will go 1911, 45, or something, you know, very custom built on those mechanicals. So it's an absolutely great cartridge, probably maybe the greatest auto pistol cartridge of all time. It may very well be. Not as prolific as the 9mm, but it definitely is the kind of cartridge that deserves to be at the very top of the list. So now that we've covered military handguns, we will cover civilian handguns. And there is some bleed over, but I've tried to kind of make that minimal as possible. So don't really have any honorable mentions, but if you have some, put them in the comments. It'd be great. And again, this is not putting down anything. This is just ones that just stood out to me as to why they're great. And you could literally, for the top five spots, there's probably 50 handguns you could put on there and make a very strong argument for. So, this is the same thing. No particular reason. No logic train going through here. That no criterion that applies to all. Just what I think are the top five. First one is high standard trophy. There are a lot of 22 target pistols out there. High standard trophy. I have personal experience with it. It was one of the more economically priced ones, but it gave performance that was the equal of much more expensive guns. And back in the era, and I miss it because I used to enjoy doing it, when bullseye pistol shooting was in vogue, the high standard trophy was a great gun to have. I used it, and frankly, I never really was the top shooter in my league. But some of the people with those Pardinis were nervous. They were looking over their shoulder because I started at the bottom, and in the space of a couple of years using my same equipment, my high standard trophy, I was able to climb up, and it was before I deployed to the Middle East and all that kind of came to an end, but I was nipping on their heels. And only a great gun could do that. Only an outstanding firearm could basically take on purpose-designed guns that were 25 or 30 years later in technology and design and everything else. So it's a testament to the quality, the design, and really the reliability and durability that the High Standard was able to do that. Okay, next on our list is the Smith & Wesson End Frame. And, you know, sorting out a specific caliber is, you could do that. You could say, hey, the 44 Magnum End Frame, you know, Dirty Harry. It basically made powerful revolvers popular, on and on. But the whole End Frame series is absolutely excellent. The 45 ACP examples, whether it's the 25, the 1917, or the 625, they're excellent, absolutely excellent revolvers. As are the ones in 44 Magnum, and even they've made them in 45 Colt, which is pretty cool. So they've made some great, great guns. To my mind, it's one of the easiest to shoot, best balanced, beautifully ergonomic revolvers out there. And it doesn't matter if it's in 38 Special or 45 Colt or 44 Magnum. They're all very accurate. They're all very pleasing to shoot. They're just great guns. So, you know, there's just not a lot more you can say about that. It a lot of people would probably put it up higher, but I think it deserves a solid number four, and I think it's absolutely, to my mind, it's the greatest, probably the greatest double action revolver save one, and we'll see that later. Okay, the next one coming up, and this is going to be another one that'll have people scratching their heads, but it's the Ruger Blackhawk. And why would anybody choose the Ruger Blackhawk? Well, at a time when America was kind of single action crazy during the heyday of the Hollywood and TV westerns, the Blackhawk came out as a moderately priced, very efficient gun, and absolutely durable, absolutely reliable. They came with excellent micro sights on the rear. They didn't look quite traditional. They had the square frames and things, but the fact of the matter is they are excellent revolvers, and they've been used for hunting, they've been used for target shooting, they've been used for all kinds of things. And you know, if you wanted a 44 Magnum before the Model 29 came out, the Ruger was actually first to the market. And it also has spawned the Super Blackhawk and the Vaqueros, and now the new Vaquero, which is actually almost the same dimensions as a Colt Peacemaker. It's the grandfather of all of those revolvers, and that is the Ruger Blackhawk. A great revolver, priced so that anyone of reasonable means could get a hold of it, and it really gave great performance. Hey, we had to take a short break between number three and number four, but we're back, and essentially number four on our list is the Smith & Wesson Auto Pistols, the 39 and 59 series, and they came out with a whole bunch of other ones, 639s, 439s, each model depending on the finish or whether it was stainless steel, you know, whatever it was, had a different designation. And then of course there was the 52, which was built on the same chassis, if you will, which was a target gun. And you know, the iterations of these things have come out over the years. They've been gone for probably 25 years now. They're pretty clunky compared to modern designs. They're single action, double action, which is out of fashion now. So, but for years, for decades, from the 1960s when they came out till the early 90s, they were a huge presence in the marketplace. And for a while, it was the only auto pistols you could get other than 1911 type pistols. And of course, they were one of the few 9mm double actions you could get on the market also, that you could actually find and buy. You know, the pre-internet days where Yeah, there was the P-38 from Germany, but you know, you weren't going to find the commercial P-38 in too many stores outside of a large city. So you could get the 39-59 series. Absolutely good guns. They're lacking today. Their trigger pulls aren't as great. They are a little big and bulky, but they're still, you know, rugged, built like tanks, and were great. And they basically whetted a lot of people's appetites for the auto pistols that came after it. So, you know, when it comes to influence, you really can't underestimate the 39 and 59 series and the impact they had on shooting and on the gun market. And of course, I say the top civilian handgun has to be the Colt Python. The Python is essentially hand-built. It was affordable by everyone, except lately. They stopped making them in 2002 or 2003. And the shame of that is they kind of lost the workforce, which had been building those things essentially by hand since the late 1950s when they were introduced. And while the Python was never inexpensive, for the quality that the purchaser received, it was outstanding. It's a hand-built gun. I mean, the things literally are a Rolex or a Rolls-Royce. They're that level of product. If you have a Randall knife, a Rolex, a Rolls-Royce, or a Bentley, and a Colt Python, you have very discriminating taste, and you like quality, because that's the quality that essentially it exhibited. So the Colt Python is number one. Plus, you know, who could forget it? It's been in all kinds of movies and TV shows. Never had quite the starring role that the Smith & Wesson Model 29 did, but the appearance of the Colt Python is just magnificent. The nickel, it is absolutely one of the most eye-catching handguns that's ever been made. And in the Colt Royal Blue, it's really a work of art to behold. It's one of those guns that almost on its own, in its factory configuration, without embellishments of engraving or anything else, it's a work of art on its own. And you see that in the prices. Even well-used examples are fetching upwards of $2,000 and maybe even more. Everyone could afford it. To go back to that point, police officers carried Pythons. Sportsmen carried Pythons. Everybody who appreciated that level of quality had a Python. So that's the top five. I'd be interested to hear your top five, military, civilian, or just whatever list you want to put together. You can always put them in the comments on Podbean, and I'd be happy to address it either in the podcast and or reply to you directly. But I love to hear what people think the top five handguns are, because there's always some interesting points of view out there, and there's always some selections that probably are very worthy of the list that I didn't think of. So anyway, again, hit any button that you like to get you a subscription or a like or a following, and we'll be looking for you on the list, and you'll get a notification when the next episode posts. But as for right now, this is Old School Guns out.